It is my pleasure to welcome you and our distinguished guests to the opening ceremony of the 29th annual Boston Harbor Fest. Today, we honor the United States Coast Guard and the United States Navy.
Boston is pretty special. The history is rich. Our Navy traditions go back a long way, and it's just great to be here.
Whether it's walking the decks of Old Ironsides or digging in at the annual Chowder Fest, this week people around Boston Harbor will be celebrating the state's maritime history. And with Harbor Fest running concurrently with Navy Week, celebrants also have a chance to see ships and meet sailors who currently serve in the United States Navy. One of them is Admiral Gary Roughead. He is the highest-ranking military officer in the United States Navy and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. As the Chief of Naval Operations, Roughead is the President's principal naval advisor. A 1973 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, Roughead also served as commandant there and is one of only two officers ever to have commanded both the U.S. Pacific and Atlantic fleets. Admiral Gary Roughead, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back in Boston and to be here during Navy Week.
Well, let me begin just by asking you, in your position, you do serve on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and in that capacity, you advise the presidents on matters regarding the Navy. One of the things that's definitely got everyone's attention right now regarding the military as a whole is President Obama's recent replacement of General Stanley McChrystal with General David Petraeus in leading the Afghan war. So may I just first of all ask you for your reaction to that and what you think sailors may have thought of this move that the president made.
Well, I think our sailors who are out and about doing the work of the Navy and the nation are totally absorbed in that, but clearly the relief of General McChrystal, someone who was heavily involved in leading our efforts in Afghanistan, was newsworthy. But I would say that one of the tenets of our profession, the profession of arms, whether you're in the Army or the Navy, the Air Force, Marines, or Coast Guard, is the civilian control of the military. And the position that we hold is to support that civilian control of the military. And as a result of the things that took place in General McChrystal's staff, I think it was not surprising to me, at least, and totally appropriate that he was relieved of his command. General Petraeus is a great commander. I know him well. The fact that he has moved to that position, I think, speaks volumes of about him as a leader, as a commander, and as a public servant. And I can't think of anyone better to move into that position. But I think the president's decision to replace General McChrystal was absolutely on target. And General Petraeus is going to be a great commander in Afghanistan.
I want to move on to another aspect where the civilian sector of our country crosses with the military. And in this case, I'm talking about commerce, specifically cargo traffic in the Indian Ocean. Because for those who haven't studied the history of the Navy very closely, one type of mission that the Navy is currently engaged in is actually anti-piracy. So describe for me, if you could, how the Navy has become one of the primary anti-piracy forces in the Indian Ocean and around the Horn of Africa as well.
Well, you mentioned it's a new mission, but it's the oldest mission we have because that's the beginning of the United States Navy, was going after the pirates in the Mediterranean on the Barbary Coast. That's our origin, and it's kind of ironic we've gone full circle in 200-plus years. But what we are doing with many other countries is patrolling an area off the east coast of Africa. The area that we're patrolling is not small. It's 130 times the size of the state of Massachusetts. The coastline is the same as the coastline that runs from Maine to Florida. And we have come together with other countries and other navies that have an interest in ensuring that flow of commerce in that part of the world to patrol against the pirates. On any given day, there'll be about 20 to 25 ships out there, and it's a very rich partnership. It's kind of an unusual partnership. China is involved, Russia is involved, NATO, the European Union, of course, the United States, Malaysia has had ships, Korea has had ships, Japan has had ships. So it's a gathering of countries that otherwise would not normally be working together, but we find that with this common threat to commerce, that we do come together. So what we do with our friends and partners is to cooperate, to coordinate, to share information, and to enable that flow of commerce to exist. And that's what navies have done for centuries. Navy's role is really to allow the oceans of the world to be used for the prosperity of nations.
At what point in time would sailors step in the event that they get a distress call that pirates have boarded, mm-hmm. you know, a tanker of some kind? What's the protocol there?
Well, what we do is, because of the number of countries that are out there patrolling, when there's a call that goes out of a commercial ship that thinks it's under pirate attack, it will put out a call that it is, and the warships that are out there patrolling will close down. In many instances, they get there before the pirates are able to do anything. And I think whether it's the ship or the helicopters that fly from the ship, it is a deterrent. The fact of the matter is that pirates don't live at sea. Pirates live ashore. That's where the criminal business is conducted. That's where they do their monetary transactions. That's where they outfit themselves. And until there's rule of law ashore where you can go and interrupt that criminal business cycle, we're going to continue to be patrolling offshore. The secret to stamping out piracy is ashore. It's not at sea. We're going to do everything we can. But until there's rule of law ashore, it's going to be counter-piracy operations for a while.
Do pirates who are apprehended come into the custody of the United States Navy, or what happens given that it's in international waters out there?
Right. What we do, it depends on whether the act of piracy is against a U.S.-owned or U.S. flagship or not. If it is against a U.S.-owned, U.S. flag, then we have jurisdiction, and then they would be moved back within our judicial system. For those pirates that are apprehended not against a U.S. ship, we tend to hold them aboard for some time and then transfer them to a country that is willing to take them and put them into their judicial system.
There recently have been, there's been one major change in terms of the makeup of the men and women of the United States Navy and how they serve together, and one potential change. And so the first one that actually did happen is that female sailors will now be allowed on U.S. Navy submarines.
Yes. Our submarine force is an extraordinary force. The men who currently serve in the force are extraordinarily capable, extraordinarily intelligent, extraordinarily dedicated. And it is clear that the young women who serve in the Navy today are extraordinary as well. And in this past year, we made the decision that we would open our submarine force to young women. We have recently completed the interviews for the first group of young women that go through, and everyone who comes into the submarine force and into our nuclear power program goes through an interview process. And we have selected the first young women to begin the nuclear training. They will complete that nuclear training and then move on to submarine school, and they'll be walking aboard our submarines in the fall of 2011. The four young women that we have selected are absolutely extraordinary. We've had more volunteers than we have openings because we have size constraints, and we're working our way through that on the accommodations that are on submarines. But I'm very eager to see those first young women report aboard our boats.
Was it difficult to convince the leadership of the submarine fleet that this was a good idea? Because, I understand for a long time the concern was they're underwater in high tension for months at a time, working at close quarters in intimate situations because they don't have much space, literally.
It wasn't difficult for me to convince them. But I would say that the leadership of our submarine force, they are the ones that are leading the introduction of women into our submarines. I think that there was angst about that. But in my case, I had the privilege of integrating young women into a ship that I commanded. And I'd be the first to admit it's not a submarine and it's not as confined. But what I saw with the quality of the young women who came aboard, their dedication, their competence, it made it a better ship. And I believe that when the young women get aboard the submarines, and indeed as they go through their training, they're going to demonstrate that they are at the top of the game. Was there some apprehension? There was. But we are headed in that direction. The young women are going to be extraordinarily successful, and our submarine force and our Navy will be better for it.
So the other issue which is pending is revoking the military standing policy of don't ask, don't tell. Currently, the Pentagon is doing a study about the feasibility of revoking that policy. But first of all, let me just ask you for your take. Is this the direction that the Navy should go?
Well, I believe that the path that we are on to do the assessment that we now have underway, and it's taking a couple of different forms, is something that we must do. Because we are an all-volunteer force, we're not necessarily the carbon copy of the nation. We have never taken a pulse of the force that serves to determine where the force is on this issue and to be able to probe and find out what some of the policy issues and personal considerations are that have to be addressed. So I believe that we need to do the assessment to determine that. And this assessment is going to inform us as to what the things that we as leaders need to think about so that we can make our best recommendation. Ultimately, the decision on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a matter of law, and that will be up to the Congress to decide. But what I tell my sailors is to participate in this assessment, to give your answer. Don't give your spouse's answer. Don't give your friend's answer or your chief's answer. We need to hear from you.
What I'm wondering, Admiral Roughhead, is that you say that you have faith that women can serve aboard submarines, for example, in these confined situations in an environment that's been exclusively male for a long time, with no damage to morale and with the expectation that everyone will still maintain the level of military professionalism that allows missions to be completed. Why can't we make the same expectations for gay members of the military to be able to serve openly with no damage to morale and the expectation that professionalism will be maintained?
Well, what I would say in the case of the young women who will be going aboard submarines, we now have a fairly significant history of young women who have served, indeed, who are rising to the highest levels of our Navy. It is something that is not unknown. But when we talk about don't ask, don't tell and the service of homosexuals in the military, we need to better understand the attitudes, the policy implications, and that is why we need to learn from the force and to understand that force much better. We in the military, as a matter of practice, do not go out and poll our sailors or soldiers as to what laws they like or don't like. So this is our first opportunity to really understand.
Well, if I can close with just one question that brings us back to Boston here. It is
sure.
Navy Week, after all. There was talk not too long ago that the USS John F. Kennedy might actually be given to Boston or might come to Boston as a permanent memorial or a museum. I was wondering if you have an update on that for us.
Yep, the carrier John F. Kennedy has served our country so well for so many decades. And, of course, just the name is a source of pride for the Navy because as you know, President Kennedy was a Navy veteran, and I think you've probably heard of his quote when he said, "Ask any man in this century what he did to make his life worthwhile. He can say with a great deal of pride and satisfaction, I served in the United States Navy." So that just kind of typifies the value that we have in John F. Kennedy. But what we do is when the ship is no longer in service, communities that are interested will make proposals to the Navy to take the ship and bring it to their community and use it as a memorial. And it'll be up to the citizens of Boston and perhaps other communities as well. But I think the aircraft carrier John F. Kennedy that served us so well can continue to be an inspiration for young men and women for decades to come.
Well, Admiral Gary Roughhead, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Magda. I enjoyed it very much.
Admiral Gary Roughhead is the Chief of Naval Operations for the United States Navy and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. To learn more about him and Navy Week activities, visit our website, wbur.org/Boston. Up next, Boston researchers unlock the predictive power of a new suite of genes that could foretell long, I mean really long, lives. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.